On this week's 51%, we see the headlines about allegations of sexual assault and physical abuse against well-known male figures.
I think that the Me Too movement is a new version, a 2017-2018 version of the personal is political.
A therapist and educator talks about coercive control. Then we dive into synchronized swimming. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Lisa Aronson-Fontes has dedicated the past two decades to making the mental health, criminal justice, and social service systems more responsive to culturally diverse people. Fontes is a senior lecturer at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of numerous publications, including the book Invisible Chains, Overcoming Coercive Control in Your Intimate Relationship. Fontes talks about her book, Coercive Control, and how today's headlines play a role.
I was a therapist for a few years, and then I've been working for the last couple of decades in the field of child abuse and violence against women. And coercive control is not very well known in the U.S., but it is becoming more known in Europe. Coercive control is a strategy that some abusers use to control their partners. It can include isolation, monitoring, intimidating, mind games and manipulation, micromanaging, and sometimes physical or sexual abuse. It's different from emotional abuse. Emotional abuse might be just one incident, or it might be a one-time incident. Coercive control is a multi-pronged strategy that has all these tactics that occur over time, so that a woman who is subject to coercive control becomes less and less free in this relationship. A lot of abusers use acts of love to control the woman's behavior, so that if she starts talking about separating or divorcing or starts showing signs of independence, he might pull her in by taking out the wedding album or telling her how beautiful she is. A lot of times the abuser defines love so that if he says love means we share all our passwords on Facebook, or love means you never leave the house without telling me where you're going, she doesn't have the power to resist. Coercive control is important for us to look at this moment, at the Me Too moment, when women are finally feeling freer to speak about the sexual assaults that they've endured, both by strangers, but more significantly and more frequently, by people they know and they've met through their work and through their personal life.
But in the speaking out, though, you're talking about women are feeling freer to voice what's happening, but we'll go to the headlines in a bit. But when we're not in the headlines and we're just looking at everyday people and their everyday lives, are those women, do you think that they're paying attention and willing to call out their partners?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I am seeing, as a university professor, I am seeing my students speaking more openly about experiences they've endured, and people I know who work directly with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assaults are reporting that they are seeing an increased number of reports. But of course, there's still a great risk for women in reporting abuse, both physical abuse and sexual abuse by a partner or a former partner. Women's names are sometimes dragged through the mud. They may risk losing their jobs. They may risk losing their position on sports teams. So even in this day and age, it's still a difficult subject to talk about.
So what can be done to help women get out of this pattern?
We might also ask what can be done to help men get out of this pattern, because I really do think we have to start with educating men and boys as to what they are entitled to and not entitled to in a relationship. But in terms of support for people who are being victimized, people should know that even if they are in a relationship and are not sure they're ready to leave it, they can still contact their local rape crisis center and their local domestic violence shelter and ask for help with safety planning. And that is definitely a resource. So oftentimes it takes multiple conversations for a person to decide to leave a relationship. I think that the police needs to be better educated about what sexual assault looks like in an intimate relationship. It's not the same as being assaulted by a stranger on the street. In the UK, in England, Wales, and more recently Scotland, they have laws against coercive control. So in addition to someone perhaps being convicted of domestic violence, they can also be convicted of controlling some their partner's finances, not letting them go out when they want, isolating them, and so on. And because of these new laws, the police in the UK have been trained to use a specific incident of assault by a partner as a window through which to look at the entire relationship.
Interesting. So what are we doing to get that in the United States? And is it difficult to enforce? Sounds like it might be.
There is the beginning of a rumbling to get laws on coercive control passed in the United States. I think we're a long ways away from it, but I'm very excited to see people beginning to work on this. These laws are really not that hard to enforce because we're not looking at litigating someone being nasty or being in a bad mood. We're talking really about extreme situations here in which the woman is not allowed to live as a free person. She's not allowed, often by her partner doesn't allow her to dress the way she wants, may prevent her from working, may time how long it takes for her to get from work to home, and question her if she's taken an extra minute or two, may control all her contacts, and so on. So she becomes very, very isolated. And when someone's isolated, they become dependent on their abuser. They don't have other sources of support in the world. So the convictions that are being obtained in the UK are quite clear. Over 200 men and recently one woman has been convicted of coercive and controlling behavior in the UK.
You know, I'd like to delve a little deeper into an answer you had, which I loved, to one of my questions. And you were talking about breaking the behavioral pattern on the male side. You know, what do we need to be doing? What kind of education needs to be out there? What is not being done?
Well, let me start a little further back with asking why is it that men are more likely to control and abuse women than the reverse? Women can certainly be bossy. I think everybody knows that. But all of society supports men in being in control. Boys are raised to get on top, to get ahead, and to get their own needs met, while girls are raised to please and support others. Girls are trained to keep other people's feelings in mind. And as women, we're raised to value romance above all else. Even when we raise girls to have careers and we tell them they should be financially independent, at the same time, we're usually teaching them to take care of everybody around them. You know, get your uncle some iced tea, take care of how your brother's feeling, and so on. So this is a setup for unequal relationships. That said, most men don't dominate their partners in this way. So in terms of education, I think we need to talk about healthy relationships in school. I think that that should be part of health class or part of the guidance counseling curriculum. I think we need to try to influence the media to portray healthy relationships. You know, the usual Disney plot line of helpless skinny girl rescued by prince isn't so healthy for our girls. And I think sometimes women's commitment to romance serves as a trap because women will keep working and keep working at a relationship which is deeply flawed and bad for them because they want it to work so much.
How is the Me Too movement helping to call out inappropriate behavior toward women?
I think that the Me Too movement is a new version, a 2017-2018 version of the personal is political. I think a lot of younger women are understanding that the oppression that they're enduring in their personal lives is broader than a personal issue. It's part of a social problem, a wide social problem. And I think that is incredibly empowering. So I do think that women of all ages and some men are free in a new way to speak about all kinds of oppression that they're enduring. The sexual harassment at work and at school and on sports teams, sexual assault, and oppression in their intimate relationships.
I was hoping you'd address your recent article in Psychology Today about intimate partners' sexual violence, and you do mention former New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who resigned amid allegations of physical abuse.
It's really shocking to see that the former head law enforcement officer in New York State, Eric Schneiderman, has been accused by at least four women of these sexual assaults within an intimate relationship, accused of hitting at least two across the head and causing them to seek medical treatment for hearing loss and dizziness, slapping, strangling, which is a really high indicator of lethality. So the reports in and of themselves are really disturbing, and I'm so grateful to these brave women who've been willing to come forward. Intimate partner sexual violence happens in many, many couples and can take a lot of forms. So in some cases, men are assaulting their women partners, as Schneiderman is accused of doing, choking, slapping, holding, raping, and so on. He's not accused of raping that I know of, but some of those other actions. In some cases, it is perhaps more subtle, that women may be coerced into acquiescing to sex when they don't want to because they feel like they have no choice. They may be told that, the abuser may tell them that they're going to look elsewhere if they aren't willing to give sex, or may accuse them of being unfaithful, and that's why you lost interest. Abusers sometimes deny their partners access to money or transportation, or just act really miserable, maybe give them the silent treatment if they don't agree to sex. So there are a lot of women who are being victimized sexually by their partners on a regular basis, sometimes even on a daily basis, and may not understand that it may be illegal, and it's not their duty as girlfriends or wives to provide sex. That's an option, and no one should be forced or coerced into being sexual when they don't want to. This is a much bigger conversation that I feel like we're just beginning. And I do think the Me Too movement opened the door to speaking about sexual assault and sexual violence in all kinds of situations. We see it today with the suit against the USA swimming coach and the Olympic swimming team. By an athlete who says she was groomed from the age of 13 by her coach and that officials knew about it. We see it in the Schneiderman case, and we see it, pretty much all over.
Now, you're involved in sexual abuse intervention in countries in Latin America, Peru, Chile, for example, and lots of other projects. What's the difference there?
In Latin America, they talk about femicide, the killing of women. And it has a particular name, obviously related to homicide. And we don't do that in the U.S. We kind of take gender out of the equation. So we fail to mention that almost every mass killer is male. Almost every mass shooter is male. Almost every serial killer is male. We fail to mention that those killers often practice at home. They start by assaulting their intimate partner, and then they go out and shoot up a nightclub or shoot up a school or shoot up an airport or plant a bomb somewhere. So we are less willing to look at the gendered component of the violence in our society than people are in some countries in Latin America. That said, I was recently in Peru doing trainings around how to interview children for child sexual abuse, and there were endless programs on the radio and the television about both femicide, the killing of women, and sexual assaults and the assaults of children. There just is not adequate training for police and social workers, and there isn't a social work system in many countries in Latin America to handle all the violence that exists. Our programs, our agencies in the U.S. are flawed for sure, but when you spend a little time in a country like Guyana, you can really see that we've come a long way. In Guyana, for instance, a country where I have been very well received and have colleagues who I would absolutely call friends, in Guyana, the police often have only an elementary school education. So they're not even comfortable writing police reports and therefore often don't bother. So many, many cases of violence against women and violence against children just get dropped.
How have you seen the internet play a role?
I'm very worried about the influence of pornography and how available it is. If I think about the pornography that was available to people when I was young, you know, maybe a Playboy magazine, compared to the pornography, the violent pornography that every school child can access on their phone or computer, it's a totally different story now. And today's pornography is quite violent. And the way pornography works is that men get used to the milder images and often will go towards things that are a little more edgy to keep themselves aroused. And so more and more men are consuming more and more violent pornography and sometimes wanting to enact these scenes with their partners. So domestic violence advocates and sexual assault counselors are reporting higher levels of injuries sustained by women through sexual assaults by their partners. And a lot of times the partners are enacting scenes that they saw on the web. So that really worries me. And through watching these scenes, they become used to seeing women suffering paired with their own arousal, and they may lose empathy. So that really worries me. On the flip side of that, I think the internet offers a lot of resources for people who are feeling isolated. So if they have safe access to the internet, women who are being victimized can find domesticshelters.org and find the domestic shelter in their area. They can find support groups on Facebook for other people who are being victimized. But they really need to be aware that a lot of times abusers will have a keystroke logger installed on their computer even without them knowing it, and may know exactly where they're going on the web and who they're talking to and what they're saying.
Lisa, anything else?
We should not look for pathology in the person who is being victimized. I think a lot of times people try to figure out, oh, why did she stay or why did she get into this relationship? I truly believe that anyone can fall prey to a relationship of coercive control or sexual violence. The problem is the bad luck of meeting a controlling or abusive person at a time when the woman is open to having a relationship and getting pulled in. We tell ourselves the problem is in the victim because it protects us from feeling vulnerable, but I really do believe that any woman can be vulnerable to this kind of abuse, and some men as well. The other thing I want to suggest is that people keep the concept of coercive control in mind as they read the news. So as we read about Schneiderman, you know, we need to think about why these powerful, smart women were feeling unfree to leave him. In addition to everything else we've mentioned, he apparently threatened to kill some of them if they tried to leave. So a lot of the abuse that we hear about on the news really is coercive control, even if that phrase is not being used.
That was Dr. Lisa Aronson-Fontes, author of Invisible Chains, Overcoming Coercive Control in Your Intimate Relationship, which is being translated into Spanish. The Subversive Sirens are a Minnesota synchronized swim team that blends art, activism, and a deep love of Prince. KFAI's Nancy Rosenbaum produced this audio portrait as the team prepared for its first ever competition at the 2018 Gay Games.
I'm Signe Haraday. Before we got into synchro, we knew nothing. I mean, to be honest, we knew how to swim, and we knew that we loved images of synchronized swimmers. We knew it was awesome, but the technical how-to, that was a little elusive.
I'm Nikki McCracken.
It's much harder than I ever thought it would be. I thought it would be dancing underwater, and it's like dancing underwater while trying not to drown.
This is like dance, but you're in the water and you're lifting yourself up. Like, wow.
My name is Zoe Holloman. So Subversive Sirens are a Minnesota-based synchronized swimming team committed to Black liberation, equity in swimming and the aquatic arts, body positivity in athleticism, and queer visibility.
I'm Tana Hargest.
I think it is really powerful to be occupying this Black body that's this shape and takes up this kind of space in the world and say, oh, I'm a competitive athlete.
My name is Susie Messerl. I'm one of the white members of the Subversive Sirens, and I think that solidarity piece is important. This access to water, access to the pool, who gets pools in their communities, who has access to swim lessons.
5, 6, 7, 8, open. 5, 6, 7, 8, close.
This is for the Gay Games.
Yes!
In Paris.
Woo-hoo!
The Gay Games will be our first competition. Our outfits are purple.
Yeah.
And our music is Prince.
Hey, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Honey, I'm rich on personality. Hey.
A lot of the formations in our free combo are star-based because we are using Prince's Baby, I'm a Star.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Star.
So you have to get used to doing the counts with the music overlay and not just getting swept away by the melody, which happens to me sometimes, especially when I listen to Prince.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1. That's all we know.
Okay,
so
yeah.
I started at 8.
A piece of what synchro is about getting so good at it that you make it look effortless. It's so graceful.
I've suffered from depression most of my life, and it's definitely worse in the winter. If I didn't have to show up and be in the pool and be accountable to everybody else, I wouldn't have left my home for a good stretch of December. So, like, this kind of saved my life. In some ways, it feels selfish in the best way because it is focused so much on us, on ourselves, and it's about generating joy in a different way.
The 2018 Gay Games are in Paris in August. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1508.